Hello and welcome to the Minimapcast. My name is Jeremy. Usually the Minimapcast is a show about video games. This week, the Minimapcast is a show about movies. Yes, that is right. I saw two movies recently that I simply could not talk about. If you've read the title of the episode, I'm sure you know what they are. They are indeed Trap and Megalopolis. I've been wanting to talk about movies on the show for a little while, wanted to do a movie show for a little while. I don't really know how to do that yet. I haven't put all the pieces together. It takes a little bit of time to get a show up and running. But I knew that the moment I started an episode the next time I had a microphone in front of me, I would be unable to bring up Megalopolis in a way that allowed the normal show to continue, and it would probably dominate a certain chunk of it. So I thought, why not give it its own room, give it its own bit of space to be spoken about, give it its own little bonus episode. And I also saw Trap recently, which I also really want to talk about. So I thought I'd do them both together. That way it's not just a complete inundation as I said to Kerry earlier, either a mini... Either a megalopopod podcast or a megalopomap. First of all, welcome to the Minimapcast. Like I said before, my name is Jeremy. Minimapcast is the premier podcast of minimap.com.au, which is an Australian independent game site. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to tell your friends and give the show a positive rating wherever you listen to your podcast. It makes a huge difference and it only takes a few seconds. If you want to get notified every time a new episode is released, make sure to follow us on social media. We are at MinimapAU on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and also Twitch. And Minimapcast also wants to say thank you to Shook for letting us use the Moog Model D Improv for the music for the Minimapcast. You can listen to more of Shook's music at shook.bandcamp.com. For those of you who are watching the video version, you might notice that this is a different scene. I am sitting, for those of you in the audio version of the podcast, I am sitting in a cinema at the moment. I'm not really, but I've put a picture of a cinema behind me with a really nice looking 3D render of popcorn that I really wish I could grab, but unfortunately, it is not real. The movies. I recently saw two films, Megalopolis and Trap. I'm going to talk about Trap first because I saw it a little bit more recently and also it came out first. So I think I want to talk about that before I sort of delve deep into my thoughts and feelings on Megalopolis. So for those of you that don't know, Trap is the latest film by acclaimed director M. Night Shyamalan, who has directed a whole host of very, very beloved movies. You might specifically know him from Signs and The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, and more recently Split and Knock at the Cabin was also him, which I've not had a chance to see yet. Trap is latest film from M. Night Shyamalan, written and directed. Also makes a really funny cameo appearance in it, but like not in a like, that's kind of cute, like that they put the director in the film that they do sometimes, like Tarantino does it, for example, where like he gives himself like a little bit of a character and it's not distracting that he's there because he's actually quite a decent actor. In the film, he plays a member of the crew for the concert that is where a majority of the film Trap is set. And he does quite a funny job because he also in the film is he's the uncle of the pop star in the film, whose name is Lady Raven. But in real life, she's his daughter. So that's just quite funny, just overall. So M. Night Shyamalan, written and directed it, stars Josh Harnett as Cooper. Alison Pill is in it as well as his wife, Rachel. Salika Shyamalan shows up at... Salika Shyamalan is Lady Raven, as I mentioned before, who was the pop star. The young Riley is played by Ariel Donahue. And Kid Cudi also has a has a cameo as well, which is funny. That's the majority of the cast. There's a couple of other members here and there. Like there's the FBI agent who is there, played by Hayley Mills. And there's Also, a guy named Jamie in the movie, played by a man named Jonathan Langdon, who plays just this incredible member of the crew at the concert who is selling merch and is obsessed with the serial killer in the film. And it's just every time he's on screen, it's a delight. That's the cast. The plot of the film is... spoilers for the film, by the way. Like, I should have said this up top, but like, I'm going to spoil both of these films. The plot of the film is that there is a serial killer called the Butcher that is going around killing people in this world. And there is a man named Krupa who is taking his young daughter named Riley, who I think she's about 12 or 13 or so, maybe younger, maybe like 10. He's taking her to this concert, this Lady Raven concert. Lady Raven is a Taylor Swift-esque singer, artist, performer. She's like got like very choreographed backup dancers. Her whole show is quite a big production. It's very Taylor Swift-esque. Not quite the size and scale, because Taylor packs out like the biggest stadiums ever, and this is not the largest stadium in the world, but it's kind of that vibe. And in this world, the Butcher is the hidden identity of the Butcher is Krupa, Josh Harnett's character. This entire concert is the titular trap, which is as they're walking into the concert, you can look around. Well, like Krupa's looking around and he's seeing lots and lots of police and heavily armed guards and like military forces or everywhere, and he's wondering what the hell's going on. And at some point he gets in a conversation with Jamie, the member of the crew for the concert, who is selling merchandise, and he lets him know that this entire concert wasn't meant to happen. It was actually, this is a trap set up so that they can catch the killer that is going around. The M. Night Shyamalan like twist thing that usually happens in films is sort of perhaps understated at this point. For a long time, you're trying to like, when you watch a lot of his films, you try and figure out where the twist is going to be. The twist in this one might just be that there is no twist. The twist in this one might be that you're not 100% sure if it is him until he reveals himself. It is him. The twist is not that it's someone else. The twist is not that it's a little girl. I know that was a fan theory for a little while, which I thought was ridiculous. The twist is not that it's the Butcher is not his wife. It is him. Where the film gets really, really interesting is that a chunk of the way through the film, so like, a lot of the first act is him like trying to find more information about this operation that's happening, trying to find more information about the trap. He's going into different rooms, like putting on a disguise, talking to some of the like police officers, overhearing a lot of conversations, a lot of very, very detailed conversations. Jamie gives him a code word that the crew is meant to be given so that they can make sure that they're on the level and not the Butcher. There's a whole thing. There's a lot of like, to bring a game analogy into it, a lot of hitmanning his way through this. Josh Harnett does an incredible job at being the most like nondescript guy for a guy that's actually very, very handsome and built and would stick out in this crowd, definitely. But he's gathering all this information so he can try and find out like a way of escaping. And on his phone, he also has a live feed of what is going to be his next victim. The Butcher is a serial killer that, from what I remember, like chops up bodies and stuff, as a butcher does, quite a violent serial killer, and has a live feed of his next victim on his phone. Hasn't killed him yet, but has him captured currently. At some point, he manages to bring him and his daughter in the situation where his daughter is going to be brought on stage as the member of the audience that is lucky enough to go on stage with Lady Raven and sing a duet and dance with her. As they mentioned in the show, that she does that to one lucky fan every concert. And so he managed to lie his way to convince the people that are involved. M. Night Shyamalan is one of the actors involved in this moment, to be brought on stage, basically to try and get him away from the crowd, to stop being someone that they're going to be looking at a lot, because like the chances of the butcher being like just off stage is like so little that no one's looking there. Everyone's looking into the crowd, looking at all the, like, they know the killer is a male man in his 40s, I believe, is, or 50s, and so they're looking for that, so they're singling out all the dads, they're questioning all the dads in the show, and so he brings himself out of that situation. Eventually, they go backstage. Lady Raven and Riley, they have a chat, and they're like, you know, she's so excited to meet this pop star, and Cooper is being really really into it, like, oh my god, you know my daughter like has recovered from this serious illness, like this is a lie that he tells to get her on stage. My daughter's recovered from this illness. Do you mind if I talk to you for a moment? And she's like, okay. At this point, he's struggling because the lockdown of the entire stadium is getting more and more intense, and he's losing his ways out. So he reveals himself to Lady Raven, saying, "Hey, you know how I know how everyone here is looking for the butcher? It's me. I'm the butcher." His whole demeanor changes. It's incredible. He shows her the footage, or the live stream of his next victim on his phone. And then says, you're gonna invite me and my daughter into your limo, and you're gonna drive us out of here, because otherwise, if you don't, I'm gonna kill him in front of you. He then tells her some information about the victim to make her feel like, to make her feel intense about this, to make her remember this guy, basically, and she doesn't want this on her conscience, so she agrees. That, I believe, is probably, like, the twist of the film, if there was one. Like, this movie doesn't need a twist. It's good. This is a good film. But, like, if there was going to be one, that would probably be it. They then play this fun game where he, well, they're in the limo, and he's, like alluding to the fact that he's got this thing on his phone but doesn't want to show it in front of his daughter. They're sort of playing this, like, cat and mouse game of, like, you know, like, let me do my thing and then we can leave. We can be out of there, but she doesn't want to just let him go. So she invites herself over to her house, and Riley's like, oh my god, yes, of course. It's so exciting. There's then this wonderful interaction between the rest of Cooper's family and Lady Raven, where they're going back and forth trying to, like, she's trying to goad him to, like, to reveal his hand, then starts to play a song for the entire family in the house. The family's unaware that Cooper is the butcher. The wife suspects, she reveals later, that he might be, or he was having an affair, because she didn't want to believe that he was a serial killer. But they don't actually know if he is the butcher or not, so they're just thrilled by this pop star in their living room. She then steals his phone. She goes live on her phone, talks to the victim on his phone while he's slamming on the door saying, give me my phone. The family's freaking out, saying, what the hell are you doing? Let her be in the bathroom. She then yells out to the family, he's the butcher. And then the rest of the film is sort of a little bit of a chase where the cops then show up, and then they escape again through the limo, and it's all, he and Lady Raven make it to a one of his backup places. This backup place is then Rachel, Cooper's wife, is aware of this. They meet, they have a confrontation there. The cops show up. He then mentions that this is the trap. Again, this is like the third time they mention the word trap in the film. Cooper is then captured one final time and then taken away. The final twist, if there was one, again, is that as he hugs his kids goodbye, steals a spoke out of a bicycle that was nearby, and then starts to undo his handcuffs as the film ends of him smiling in the back of this police car. That's the plot of the film. It's hard to explain that one without perhaps getting in that much in detail as I can. I don't want to begin to think about how I'm going to start to explain Megalopolis a little bit later. But that's the crux of the film. There is another subplot which Cooper keeps seeing the ghost of his mother, but it was also seeing it at the same time as he's seeing this FBI agent who was an older woman, not quite as old as his mother in these visions that he's having, but they sort of start to meld a little bit because she is clearly reminding him of his mother. There's not a whole lot to that subplot. Like, it doesn't really go anywhere aside from there's a moment where he thinks he's talking to his mother, but he's actually just talking directly to the FBI agent. I didn't particularly find that subplot too engaging. I don't think it was the most necessary thing in the world. Not that things need to be necessary, but I didn't gain a lot out of that undertone. I think it worked without it, for example. I need to talk about how good Josh Hartnett is. There are so many times in this film he is acting. His character is acting as a different version to himself. Cooper and the Butcher, his two competing personalities, when he switches between each one every single time, it is thrilling because you can see it in his body, in his demeanor, in the way he's presenting himself, the way he's breathing and smiling and speaking. He's so good at swapping between one and the other that anytime it happens, it's really actually exhilarating. There's a moment where he bumps into one of Riley's friends is there, and Riley and Riley's friends have been having a falling out lately, and Cooper bumps into the mother of Riley's friend, and they have this kind of sharp, pointed conversation where the mother's like, "I really hope they could be friends again. You know, I think they're really good together." And Cooper is sort of saying, "Yeah, well, like, you know, she sort of hurt Riley's feelings by excluding her and some stuff," which is what the film's conversation begins with, which is a lot of the conversation about Riley telling Cooper about how she's been going with school and her friends and stuff. And he's quite, I think that's the closest he gets in the entire film to being the Butcher in like as Cooper, because he's quite upset at it, and his eyes are sort of twitching while they're talking, and these two parents clearly don't get along very well, as often, you know, parents don't always get along, because that's just sort of how that is sometimes. And so these two, this mother of this one girl and this father of this other are clearly not seeing eye to eye with how both of their children have presented this story about how they've been drifting a little bit. And so they're quite, there's a lot of like tension in that scene. For a film that is about a serial killer that is hiding from cops in an entire stadium that is designed to trap him, that is maybe one of the most tense moments in the scene, at least in the first half of the film. I think that Salika Shyamalan, the woman who plays Lady Raven, I think she does a really good job at being perhaps the most like generic pop star performer, at least when she's on stage. Her songs, like, everybody's kind of doing this like sway dancing thing, and I think they do a good job at making the kids feel like that they're doing like almost TikTok dances to songs that they have obviously listened to like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. I think that part of it is really good, but I couldn't tell you a single song. I couldn't tell you a whole lot about her actual like voice, but when she's on stage, when there are scenes where it's actually about her talking to the crowd, when she's talking to Riley on stage, when she's talking to Riley off stage, I think she does a really tremendous job at being that type of character. She really feels quite believable. And then when she's live streaming herself in the bathroom, at that point she's telling everybody like, "Hey, I'm trapped in this bathroom. I need someone to go to this address. Basically the victim has told her some information about where he is, but he doesn't quite know where he is. So then she goes live to her millions of fans, does the like does the weaponization of fans thing to get information as quickly as possible by reaching as many people as possible by going on Instagram Live, tells everybody their information, then tells people to go to that house and hopefully they'll find someone who is kidnapped down there and is able to free them. It ends up working really efficiently. Like, the most efficient force in the world is is fans on Instagram Live. I thought that was a really, really intelligent, modern way to deal with the whole, like, oh, everybody's going to phone. How do you do a thriller? How do you do a mystery movie when everyone's so connected? I think that's a really good way of feeling like a modern thriller. I really, really appreciated that moment. The final thing that I really want to talk about in Trap is just how good the camera is in the movie. Like, there are so many tremendous shots of especially Cooper. Like, he's the guy you see the most in the film. There are so many amazing shots of when he's sort of embodying the butcher, when he's becoming the butcher in certain scenarios, and he's either like maybe half off camera with the edge of the frame straight down the center of his face. And he's just kind of standing there very imposingly. There's a lot of scenes of him looking directly down the barrel of the camera. He's got this terrifying face at times, this obscenely creepy smile with his eyes, but his eyes are still kind of like not twitching, but they don't look sincere, but they're the eyes of someone who has killed someone and then doesn't know how to have a sincere smile, but is doing it just to get information, talking to someone, talking to Jamie, talking to like some other people that is like just lying to get some more information, people that he tells that his daughter's got cancer, all of this stuff. He does a tremendous job of it, and the camera keeps putting him in these really interesting positions in the frame that every time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's so evocative. This film is so, it really does command your attention. I didn't see this one in the cinema. I was watching this one at home, but the way that, like, you're able to see this one, I wasn't looking at my phone. I wasn't, like, you know, looking on my laptop. I wasn't looking at something else. It grabbed me and it did not let me go, especially due to the fact just how intelligent so much of the camera work is. It was so, so cool. That shouldn't be a surprise. M. Night Shyamalan, tremendous director, really good writer a lot of the time. Like, he knows what he's doing. But it's so good to see someone who is kind of going through like a little bit of a, like, not a renaissance, because it implies that he sort of disappeared a little bit, but he's going through another one of his strong phases at the moment. Like, Knock at the Cabin, I think a lot of people really liked. Old, yes and no, but like Split, a lot of people really loved. This is, like, I think another really good movie. He's a really exciting director. He makes really exciting movies a lot of the time. This is no exception. On my Letterboxd, I gave this movie a 4 stars. It's not a 5. It's not a film that I think is a must-see thriller film, but I think it's a really good one from this year. I really enjoyed it. All right. Now, let's get to what is perhaps the main event. Megalopolis, a tale, a fable. What's it called? Megalopolis, a fable. So where the fuck do I begin? So Megalopolis is the latest and perhaps last film from acclaimed director Francis Ford Coppola. Megalopolis has been known to be the film that he's been trying to get made for 20 odd years, had a tremendous amount of trouble getting financing for it, had to rewrite it a bunch of times because he would, apparently he's been known to been writing this film for like, or had this idea in his head for 40 years. New things in the world would happen, events, technology, a lot of things. 40 years, a long time to write one story. Things keep changing, so he keeps rewriting it. He rewrote it. Apparently, he rewrote it when 9/11 happened, for example. He's rewritten it for different pieces of technology, for example. Whole lot of reasons he's been rewriting it. But Megalopolis is a film that he's been unable to get finance for a very long time, and then it recently had to put up a lot of his own money, like I think $130 of his own money or something. It's $120 of his own money, according to NPR, where he sold his wine business. He had a winery, or sold at least a lot of some. He owned some part of a winery, for example. Got rid of all of that so that he could finally get the money to finance this film that he's been trying to make for a long time. For those of you that aren't aware, Francis Ford Coppola is one of the most famous directors probably in history. He is responsible for the Godfather trilogy. He did Apocalypse Now. He did The Outsiders. Bram Stoker's Dracula is the one I was trying to remember. He's done a lot of films. Or rather, he's done big films. I don't know if he's done a tremendous amount of films, but a lot of the films he's done are regarded as very, very important. It's worth pointing out that Francis Ford Coppola at the moment is also sexual misconduct on set. He was allegedly very inappropriate to some women that were on set of Megalopolis. It's worth looking that up because it's important to know a lot of that stuff. However, yes, Megalopolis has been a thing that he's been trying to make for a very, very long time. Once he finally started production a couple of years ago, he got a cast. From my memory, both Zendaya and Oscar Isaac were attached at some point and then they dropped out. But the cast of Megalopolis is Adam Driver, Giancarlo Esposito, Natalie Emmanuel, Aubrey Plaza, Shia LaBeouf, John Voight, Lawrence Fishburne, Talia Shire, Jason Schwartzman, and Catherine Hunter. Those are the main players in this film. The plot of the film is, so Megalopolis is a film that is, it's a Roman film. It's a film about Romans in Rome, except it's the modern day, I believe, and set in America, but it's Rome, America. It's sort of like they don't really get into detail. They don't get into a lot of detail in this film in about like a lot of the specifics. They don't get into specifics in the film is what I should say, not detail. They don't get into specifics. But my understanding is that this is a world where if Rome never fell, this is a possibility of what it would have been like if Rome had continued on. And the Empire of Rome perhaps was, this is what it could look like. Adam Driver plays a man named Caesar Catalina. He's a part of the Catalina family. The Catalina Crassus family is the most rich, wealthy family, in all of New Rome, which is where it is set. And they are a family of great importance. They own the bank in this city. They are the richest people, the richest family. Caesar Catalina has got this vision, this idea for what this utopia could look like for Rome, for New Rome. And Giancarlo Esposito plays Mayor Cicero, who is the newly elected mayor. Not a very popular mayor. Basically, everywhere he goes, he's getting booed. He is this mayor who doesn't believe in the vision of Caesar. He is not here to go on this, what he believes is a fantasy dream for what the world could be. He's very into, like, like kind of like liberalism, like let's make very, very small steps around this stuff. Let's do things that we know that we can achieve, as opposed to dreaming big in a more brainy sort of way, a more heady idea for what the world could be. Natalie Emmanuel plays Mayor Cicero's daughter, Julia. She ends up having falling in love and having a relationship with Caesar. She is someone who sort of brings the mayor and Caesar together a lot of the time, where they can have these ideological debates while also understanding that they are getting to a point where they are family, or at least going to be a part of each other's lives in a meaningful way. Aubrey Plaza, it's so hard to get into this film without just sort of going through the cast. Aubrey Plaza plays a reporter named Wow Platinum, which is perhaps the greatest name in all of film. Wow Platinum. Her first name is Wow. She plays a reporter who is in love with Caesar, and then ends up marrying the head of the Crassus family to gain access to the bank. She's sort of a little bit of a rogue agent, where she like is doing things because she's in love with Caesar, but is also playing her own game and sort of resents the fact that she has so much feelings for him, but still is definitely her own thing. And then there is the Crassus family at large, which is Hamilton Crassus, who's played by John Voight, who's a piece of shit in real life. Shia LaBeouf, who plays Claudio, who is the son of Hamilton, the heir of the Crassus fortune, and also Caesar's cousin. Also, I think a piece of shit in real life. And there is also the mother of Caesar, played by Talia Shire. The rest of the supporting cast, they don't have a tremendous amount to do, but they're sort of there. Primarily Jason Schwartzman is there. He plays this guy named Jason Zanders, who is the right-hand man to Mayor Cicero. I don't really know what he does in the film. He's got a handful of jokes that are hilarious, but most of his lines are kind of like, I couldn't tell you a single thing that he says. Aside from at the very end when he gets a photo taken with him, it's very strange. And there's also Lawrence Fishburne as well, who plays Caesar's driver and confidence man, and so he's confidant, not his confidence man. Plays his right hand man. He's sort of always there to help him out. He also serves as the narrator of the film. He kind of I believe at some point he refers to himself as the chronicler. Where it sort of feels like he's the one that's telling the story of this age, that is happening. So the film begins with Caesar revealing to the audience that he has this ability to control time, or rather has this ability to stop time. He can at will seemingly pause time for a fairly short amount, but can stop time. He's also in charge of a thing called the Department of Design or something. I apologize if I get some of this wrong. There's a lot going on in this film. But he's basically the one that is taking control over certain parts of this city, of New Rome, to build up his vision of what the city should be in his mind. Mayor Cicero is this, as I said before, this newly elected mayor. He's not very liked. Everyone sort of looks at him as kind of just like another bureaucrat, seems to not be very capable or competent as a mayor. But that's basically where he's at with a lot of the stuff. And him and Mayor Cicero have a lot of moments where they're going back and forth about like, oh, like, well, I own this plot of land and me as the mayor are going, like, what could be better than putting a casino right here? That will be so great for the entire city. And everyone's like, boo. And then Adam Driver's Caesar is like, actually, well, I already own this part of this land, and it's going to be part of my grand vision of the world that is going to be made new with Megalon, which this fantasy substance that he's building cities with that seems to change form every time it is depicted on camera. Dustin Hoffman is in it as well as like Mayor Cicero's like other right-hand man. And he's like saying, hey, we don't need Megalon. We need concrete and steel. That's what Rome was built on, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't really have a whole lot to do. It's kind of a weird role for him, but he's there. Anyway, we're like 10 minutes into the film at this point. This Megalon is this structure that Caesar Catilina discovers. He wins a Nobel Prize for creating this material. That happens before the film begins. He's a Nobel Prize winner for inventing Megalon, which is a substance that most people don't even really know what it is yet. People are still asking him when he's being interviewed by journalists that at parties and stuff, like, is this safe? Is this like a dangerous substance, or is it a thing we can use? And he reassures him that it is safe but not before joking that it is dangerous, which it seems to not be. Then at some point in the film, Caesar invents a dress made out of Megalon, which has got cameras all around it and screens that are projecting the opposite end of the dress, so that the woman who's wearing it, a woman named Vesta Sweetwater, when she's wearing it, she looks invisible when she's wearing it, aside from the parts of her that are not covered by the dress, which is just her shoulders and the bottom of her legs. So at early on in the film, Adam Driver, Caesar, has this back and forth with Mayor Cicero, sort of embarrasses him, calls him a slumlord, embarrasses him in front of a lot of journalists and press. Julia Cicero, Mayor Cicero's daughter, then, says, well, I'm going to try and bring this guy down. They meet earlier in the film. He witnesses part of this time manipulating ability. It's not clear how she is not affected by this, but she was not. At some point, if a building is getting destroyed, he stops it mid destruction and then allows it to continue to just, I guess, observe it. She witnesses this thing. And there's a clip online, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen by now, but it's a part of the film where they meet for the first time and they are having this back and forth about, like, why are you here? Like, why are you wasting my time? I'm this big-brained inventor and you've done 1 year of med school. Go back to the club. at this point, she reveals that he knows about... she reveals that she knows about his time-manipulating ability. They then start to work together. They get into a relationship together. She sort of becomes his muse at this point. He loses his ability to time manipulate the world. And when she knows this and then goes back to him, she is like, well, why don't you stop time for me? And he goes, what do you mean stop time for me? And she goes, just try it. And so he does, and suddenly he can stop time again. And then they kiss on these girders that are impossibly high above this city. And they fall in love and have a baby. And there's a whole other side of the story where Shia LaBeouf's character Claudio is hates his cousin hates Caesar because everybody loves Caesar and no one loves him. And he's like a brat. He's like a piece of shit. He's like cocky and arrogant and his dad hates him and all this stuff. He's not immediately going to get the inheritance, basically, where Hamilton Crassus implies that he's not going to be given the heir to the Crassus Catilina fortune, the bank and all that stuff. So he tries to take down Caesar Catilina as a form of anger towards him, by inciting a populist revolution by going to a lot of the homeless people in this world and starts to create an uprising that is very like fascist. and then at the end of the film, after Adam Driver reveals this megalopolis and starts to make this rousing speech so everyone can say, yes, this the future is for all of us in this version of this utopia that I've made. The entire populist movement immediately turns on Claudio and starts to beat him up and hang him by his feet. It's wild. This happening at the same time as WoW Platinum says, well, I want to take control of the bank, and so double crosses her new husband, Hamilton Crassus, starts to sleep with Claudio, and together they take over the bank by causing Hamilton to seemingly have a stroke. It's then revealed that that's not it doesn't actually happen. He then pulls a bow and arrow from under his under the sheets, where he's telling everybody he has an enormous erection, and then reveals himself only to have a bow and arrow and shoots WoW Platinum in the chest with a bow and arrow, and then Claudio in the ass. There's also another, and finally there's another subplot where Vesta Sweetwater, the woman who is wearing the dress made out of this megalon, she is known as this, like, she's brought in as a virgin tribute where the rich and powerful are able to bid on her for the city's benefit as a way of, like, paying tribute to the old ways. Seemingly they're buying her virginity. It's not immediately clear, but I believe that's the implication. And she does this performance, this really, like, stunning performance where she's singing on top of various moons, kind of like the DreamWorks logo. And Claudio hijacks the broadcast in the Colosseum, plays a doctored video of Vesta Sweetwater, who was meant to be this 16 or 17-year-old virgin. This doctored video of Vesta and Caesar Catalina sleeping together. This causes Caesar to be arrested, gets let out of prison with the help of Julia by proving to everybody that this is not statutory rape, because she finds her birth certificate and finds out that it not only is she 23, actually not 16, they also find out the fact that the video is not real. It's been edited, so he gets released, and that's where he loses his ability to make things. Also, at some point, part of Claudio's plot is he eventually gets some people to cause a distraction on the street, and gets a small child also to go over to Caesar and say, hey, can I get your autograph? And they have this small little interaction where Caesar's being quite nice to him, like, oh, what's your name? Oh, how old are you? I used to be that age, yada yada. And then the kid pulls out a gun and shoots Caesar directly in the face through the eye and kills him, seemingly for about 6 minutes of the film before the megalon gets planted back into his face. And within 10 minutes of the film, he's back to normal. There's a lot in this film. Okay, so I apologize if that was long-winded. It is. It's a long-winded film. I saw it described as a film that goes for 2.5 hours, feels like it goes for 3.5 hours, and also feels like it's meant to go for 4.5 hours because of how quickly it jumps around. That's a pretty accurate way to describe this film. This is perhaps the most insane film I've seen in a very, very long time, if not ever. First of all, I think, for the most part, the cast is great. I think that Adam Driver kills it. Natalie Emmanuel does an incredible job. Giancarlo Esposito finally is able to use some acting chops that he's got that isn't just be Gus, please. Aubrey Plaza plays an incredibly unhinged WoW Platinum that is a pleasure to watch. Lawrence Fishburne seems to know that you're there and just likes to look directly down the barrel of the lens a lot of the time, which I guess in a way makes sense considering he's like the narrator of the film and the one chronicling this era, aside from the fact that it is uncanny every single time and he's often just watching down the barrel of the camera in scenes of people doing things, not actually doing anything until they leave and he's still there and you realize he's been looking at you the whole time. It's wild. I think the worst performance is honestly John Voight as Hamilton Crassus. He doesn't really do much in the film. I think what he has to do, he doesn't actually do a particularly good job at it. He's really quite old at this point, and I don't know if he's really got it in him. I didn't really like his performance. I don't like him as a person, and I didn't really like his performance. And so it kind of lended, like, that just kind of feels good. I think it's weird that he's in this film at all, considering he like really sucks. But yeah, it's I don't think he does a very good job. I think that they should have got someone else to do it. Okay, so when I saw this film, I saw it 2 times in 2 days, which is an insane thing to do. I went to a small independent theater to see it first. And then on the second day, I went to the largest theater in Melbourne. I went to the IMAX theater to watch it. When I saw it on opening night, it was in a cinema full of people that go to independent cinemas. And so everyone's kind of like, I reckon the average like percentage of people that have a Letterbox in that room is probably close to 80%. Letterbox hosts a lot of screenings at the cinema that I'm talking about. So like, it wouldn't surprise me, but everyone was ready to watch Megalopolis, a film that they had been paying attention to for the better part of 2 years at least. They probably all were very familiar with the reaction it got out of Cannes Film Festival, which was either thunderous applause or leaving the cinema before it was happening, before it left. They were aware of this and were ready to watch what has been regarded as kind of a mess, both good and bad. All of that in mind, there was still like maybe 30 out of the 250 people, 300 people in the cinema that left before the film began. The earliest people that left my screening, I think they left within the first half an hour of the film. They just got up and walked out. That, like, the look on their face was, I don't want to keep watching this. This is too weird. I'm not enjoying this. The realization that you get about 20 minutes into the film that it's going to be like this the whole time and only get more and more bonkers, I cannot begin to comprehend how surreal that feeling is. It is one of the most bizarrely paced films I've ever experienced. There are so many moments in this film that, like, there's a sequence in the film that might go for 8 minutes. In that 8 minutes, you will get the most unhinged dialogue, the strangest performance, and the most bizarre effects overlaid onto, like, some pretty intelligent camera movement that, like, I have ever seen. And it happens over and over and over again. People were laughing. I was laughing. There were moments in this film where someone would say just the most, like, insane thing ever. No one in the cinema would react. Someone in the cinema would then pipe up just with, like, a cackle, and that would cause the entire cinema to erupt in laughter. I can't believe it. It's wild. It's bonkers. It's a truly bizarre film. And I came out of it going, I can't believe what I just saw. I can't believe that went for 2.5 hours. I can't believe that was as strange as everyone was saying it was. You know, sometimes you hear movies like, oh, they're so weird. Isn't that funny? And you watch it like, yeah, it's not that weird. Like, it's a little weird at times, but it's not that weird. This is truly weird. In an off-putting way. In a really, like, I get why people don't like this film. I get it. But I came out of it going, I don't know how to tell people to watch that film. I don't know how I feel about this film. Did I like it? Did I hate it? I genuinely have no idea. I don't think it matters. It sort of rejects you having an opinion on it almost. or rejects you coming to a conclusion on it, I think is maybe a better way to describe it. It doesn't care about how you feel at the end of it. It's there purely for you to think about. And then I went to see it a second time. And I'll be completely honest with you, I was dreading it a little bit. I was exhausted by the idea of going to watch this film about 24 hours later. Again, I was exhausted by the concept of sitting in the cinema with the group of, like, a different adjacent group of people that were also going to watch this film at the IMAX on opening night and experience that again. And then about 10 minutes into the film, I was like, oh, okay. I think I'm really here for this now. And then 20 minutes into the film, I was sitting there going, am I loving this? And then 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, I kept on thinking to myself, I'm fucking loving this. I am really having a great time watching this. And you know how that makes me crazy? The film hadn't changed. I saw it a day later. Why did I feel that way? Suddenly it clicked. Or maybe it didn't click. Maybe I clicked with it. I don't really know. But suddenly it was available to me and I got to grasp it and engage with it and appreciate it. And I now love this film. I think this might be it's definitely the most interesting film I've seen all year, but this might be the best film I have seen all year. Granted, I've got to catch up a little bit on this year. I've been a little bit behind, but this was one of the coolest films I've ever seen. So much of this film is perhaps a rejection of being literal. There are so many moments in this film where important, almost cataclysmic events take place in this film. There's one particular that I'm going to talk about, which is a satellite crashes down onto New Rome, and it's a satellite that has been, like, it's got CCP written on it, like communist, no, yeah, the China's Communist Party. CCP? Yeah, Chinese Communist Party. It's got that written on the side with like big red and white text. Throughout this film, they keep cutting to it as if like, oh, this satellite's slowly going to crash. Where's it going to crash? Somewhere in Canada. It's going to crash. And then within the span of 2 minutes, suddenly it starts to crash down and you realize it's going to crash on New Rome. Of course it's going to crash on New Rome. The film's about New Rome. Also, like, it's got, like, Carthage written on it, which is a civilization which was, like, destroyed by Rome. Like, so utterly destroyed by Rome that for a long time historians weren't aware that Carthage existed or wasn't. We weren't super clear on how much of Carthage did exist, but apparently the Roman Empire, like, destroyed it to dust and destroyed all their culture so that no one would know that they existed. The satellite's called Carthage. I don't, like, it doesn't immediately make sense because it seems like the opposite of what's going on. Anyway, that's my understanding of the history of Carthage in Rome. So this satellite crashes onto the city and it destroys it. There's so much of the city is destroyed, which is why they rebuild part of it through the Megalon and Caesar Catalina finally creates the Megalopolis, I guess. This utopia out of the CGI that is used in Spy Kids and the prequel Star Wars prequel films. When the satellite hits the ground is covered in this smoke and this haze, and instead of showing huge explosions, CGI, buildings collapsing, all you get are these shots, which are in the trailer. These shots are in the trailer, but this is the context behind them, where there's these shots of just the shadows of like few people, like two or three people per building, just being like broadcast onto these skyscrapers of these people with their arms like blown. Oh my God, I just figured out what it is. It's Pompeii. Okay, it's Pompeii. So, like, okay, I'm figuring this out live. So, it's the shadows of Pompeii. That's what he's evoking there. Okay, all right. It's the volcano erupting. But yeah, there's a moment where. It's this moment where these shadows are being, like all you can see, these bright lights are illuminating these buildings, and these figures are like, they look like they're wailing in pain just briefly, because it's just like flashing lights as it's happening. And it's like one of the most incredible shots I've ever seen. It's so evocative. It is so stunning. And it's full of that. The shot of Caesar Catalina and Julius Cicero above the city on his weird, like, time area where he does his planning with his spyglass. There are these girders that are hanging from impossible cranes. Or impossible, you don't get the establishing shot of this. You don't get the scene where you understand what the girders are hanging from. It doesn't matter. There are girders above the city, and Caesar is standing there, and Julia visits him, and they have this wonderful interaction, and they kiss, and they're kissing while hanging off part of a girder, and he's got his arm around her waist, like holding her body against him while she's leaning off of a girder, like against his body for the embrace and kiss. And it looks like something that was like put together in an advertising boardroom of like, you know, go see New York, the city under construction, or like, you know, like the building the city of your dreams, like this imperfect poster. And it's just there for an entire scene, and it's breathtaking. It's incredible. There are so many moments like that. The opening, or one of the opening scenes where Caesar and Mayor Cicero are having this back and forth about what should be the future of this new plot of land. And this entire sequence is set in a huge warehouse that has got this like massive like scale replica of the city, but like the city is maybe two or three stories high, and they're all standing on these rickety catwalks, like the kind of thing that you would see above a film studio. Or above a concert where like people walk across that are like managing spotlights and you know, like running cables and stuff. It's all these rickety catwalks. And so there's this entire sequence where there are these two powerful men are having this debate about what should be the future of the city. And they're literally standing above the city that they're trying to decide what should be the future of. There are reporters and photographers surrounding them on basically every side, taking photos while they are like, they are monologuing at each other. Dialoguing? They're having this entire moment where they're acting at each other for the cameras, for the audience, for each other. They're trying to get under each other's skin. It's so good. This film is still a mess. This film is messy. Like, there is nearly no, like, problem or issue or conflict in the film that doesn't get resolved within 15 minutes. It is, like, the dialogue is utterly bizarre. There's, like, 10 or 12 bespoke sequences across the entire film, and they don't particularly lead into one or the other. They just kind of happen, and it's like you're watching a scene in a play where now is the time where we're watching the thing happen, where these characters are in this scene with this background, and we're going to watch this entire sequence, and then we're going to move on to the next one. And it's also broken up by like five or six of these like old-fashioned film slates where there's text, like metaphorical text about the future that Lawrence Fishburne is reading, that this text is etched in stone and then it goes into the new chapter of the film. But it's not a three-act structure. There's not just three chapters. There's like eight or nine, or maybe like five or six. It is... And it's also almost incomprehensible. When the film gets maybe five-sixths of the way through, you don't really know where it's going to end. You don't really know what's going to happen next. You're not immediately sure what's just happened. And the film repeatedly shocks you. Not with things that are like shocking, but it shocks you with the direction that it is in the middle of taking. It's like being scared mid-corner when you're traveling at like 100 kilometers an hour. Not you're scared you have to turn that corner at 100 kilometers an hour. You're scared mid-corner. It's already started and you're not immediately sure where the end of it is. It's so much. I was also lucky enough to see this film with the live element, which included part of the film. Everything stopped for a moment and the lights came up in the theater, and then a real life person walked to the front of the theater up to a microphone on a stand, mimed a question or two for Adam Driver on screen to then respond to while the audio of the question played, and they positioned the microphone at the point in the cinema where it looks like Adam Driver is looking directly at the person who is asking the question. And then after that, that scene ends and the person then has to then walk back up through the cinema as the lights then go back down for the rest of the movie. And it takes like 4 minutes, but that's just what happened while everyone looks around going, okay. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I don't know if there will ever be another film like this. I don't know if any film like this will ever be made again. I'm sure it will in some sense, but to wrap it up, I have a couple of inspirations, or at least my film likens that I liken this film to. When I came out of the first screening, the first film that I immediately thought of, and like this is very on brand for me, but the first film I immediately thought of was Star Wars, but not like the original Star Wars. It was the prequels specifically, because the way the prequels were made is that George Lucas had written out a tremendous amount of scenes. He did this for the prequels and did this for the Clone Wars as well, where what he would do is he would film a tremendous amount of coverage across a lot of scenes, and then he would take it all and then assemble the film in the editing room. This was not quite for efficiency. I'm sure it was kind of efficient, but this was because George Lucas is a big film nerd. He really, in his heart of hearts, he's still an independent filmmaker. And he wanted to try out a new way of making a film. What better place to do that than a Star Wars film? Mixed success. Definitely mixed success. Especially with the first film and the second one. But specifically Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. One and two. But the way he did it is he put together these films where he was assembling what the film's shape was and the film's feeling was after they had already filmed. It's also why they use so much CGI in the prequels. Granted, they didn't use, I think, as much as some people think they did. There was still a lot of miniatures. There was still a lot of scenes. You know, Naboo, it's just Venice. It's just Tuscany. It's just Italy. That's all it is. But there's a lot of the film that was decided in post. He did the same thing with Clone Wars. One of the reasons Clone Wars became a very efficient show to make later down the track was because they would build these sets, basically. the 3D environments, they weren't just 3D environments where the where the camera was going to be. They would build a 3D environment, and then they would place the characters in the 3D environment. They would then animate the characters doing things, and then they would bring in the camera, and they would direct it kind of like a real film, where they would, not to say animation isn't real, but they would direct it like a film that is shot on location with people. They would scout in their own digital environments for the most interesting place to put the camera, to put the actors, to put the objects, all that stuff, and build it in a kind of like a game engine. And then they would build the show part of the show in post, which is a wild thing to do. It also meant they had to be really economical. If you want to know more about that, the entire More Civilized Age podcast talks a lot about that. They talk about when they get a new set, when they get a new model. It's like, it's a whole thing. It's very, very fascinating. A lot of that comes from the behind the scenes of the show that was on a lot of the DVDs and Blu-rays for the show. It's very fascinating stuff. This film feels the same. My original thought was that felt like the prequels because it felt like a lot of disjointed scenes that had bizarre CGI and had this weird green screen effect where no one really felt like they were on set, but it was still there. Then when I watched it a second time, I was like, oh my God, this feels like the prequels where it feels like Megalopolis was assembled after the fact. I cannot imagine what the screenplay was like leading into production. I don't know if it was the same as the movie that we got. I don't know if it was close. I don't know if it was entirely different. I don't know if it was four times longer than what we have. It feels like there's a lot missing, but not in a way that I feel like the film is lesser for it. It just feels like that there was a lot of things that were done for this film that might have then not quite worked in the edit. And then like the film was then reshaped in the edit, which I think is a fantastic way to do things at times. I think it's an interesting way of doing things always. The other film that I liken this to is a film called The People's Joker, which is a film about Joker, who is, well, like a film about a trans woman named Joker the Harlequin, and her journey of, like her journey about her gender and transitioning and her place in the world, and it's directed by a woman named Vera Drew, who also plays Joker the Harlequin. The film was created during lockdown. There's a lot of green screen in that film. There's a lot of people just being superimposed onto sets and images and videos of sets. It's a film that a lot of people I think describe as like, oh, it's got bad CGI. Like not quite. It's stylized. It's definitely done with intention. It's done out of necessity, but it's also done with intention. The visual look and feel of The People's Joker, which is often, it looks like there's someone in front of a green screen. It looks like me in front of the green screen now. This is a really high quality image behind me of some seats. That popcorn kind of, like, you could realistically believe that I went over and picked it up, right? That's because the quality of the background and the quality of the camera are like close enough that you can tell it's not real because the lighting is different, the shadows are different. I'm not projecting shadows and all that stuff, but it looks real enough that I could realistically be in there, but you still know I'm not. That's kind of the vibe of a lot of the scenes in The People's Joker, which is a film that I love, by the way. The People's Joker is a tremendous film that I definitely recommend you watching. Vera herself also put up her review of Megalopolis just the other day, which, like, you should also read that on her letterbox, because it's also, it's fascinating because she's got her own stuff about Francis Ford Coppola that she dealt with a little bit, and his history there as well. But definitely recommend checking that out. But a lot of people were like, oh, this kind of feels a little bit like The People's Joker. And I was like, I remember reading that going like, how the hell is that possible? And then I was watching it. I was like, it is. It feels like The People's Joker made by an 80-year-old. And that's kind of neat. Megalopolis is a mess. It's a very, very very uneven mess. I think that why I gave this film my review on Letterboxd, which was a 4.5-star review out of 5, was because, one, my second screening was kind of a moment of enlightenment where I was sitting here going, like, I can't believe I'm loving this. But I think it's because of just how different it felt. And Kerry will always have a funny jab at me whenever I say it really swung for something. And I often find things that really try for something different to be much more interesting than things that do a really good job at something I've seen a million times or have experienced a million times. We talk about that a lot on the podcast. But this is maybe the most that really swung for something, anything that I've ever seen. And I cannot help but respect it. Don't have to respect the director as a person. You don't. But the film itself was so singular. It is so unique and so uninterested with, honestly, how the audience feels about it. So disinterested with it being able to have, like, opinions on it, almost. It sort of feels like a film that came out of an alternate world where perhaps a lot of films are like this. This feels like a film that had been built off a foundation that seems to be invisible to a lot of people, or like that is not a foundation that is known by most people. I certainly am not familiar with this type of film. This is not a film that I think you can look at something else and go, oh, well, that clearly comes, like, this film is clearly inspired by that. There are elements of things. Sutherland Tales is one. I think, again, the Star Wars prequels is another. But it firmly feels like a thing that is just straight out of the brain of someone that wants to do something entirely new. And I think that's neat. And so I recommend every single person watch Megalopolis, just so you know what a different film can feel like. That's my recommendation at the end of this. Watch Trap, but watch Megalopolis, definitely. Go see it at the cinema. Experience it with other people. It was great to see it with other people. It was a shared experience in a cinema, which usually I hate. But that was unbelievable how much everybody was reacting to it, both positively and negatively. Unbelievable experience. Absolute scenes in the cinema. That was the mini map Megalopalooza, or the mini Mapalopolis, or the mega Mapalopolis. That's the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it. Next episode is not going to be about movies. Next episode is going to be about games. I think this is just going to be a bonus episode in the feed. There's not going to be a numbered episode, but I very much thank you for making it all the way to the end of this episode. I'm not the most confident talking about films into a microphone a lot of the time, so this is a little bit of a new area for me. So I apologize if it was a little bit rough at times or a little bit long in the tooth. This is a newer area for me. But I appreciate you making it all the way through this episode. What an episode to start with. What an episode to listen to, just in terms of the subject matter. But yeah, I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed it, make sure you tell your friends. Give the show a 5-star rating. It really makes a big deal for us. And if you enjoyed any of the other episodes, or if you like Minimap and what we do, make sure to head to patreon.com/minimapau for everything that we do, and consider throwing us $5 to become a Patreon. It's cheaper than a latte with oat milk, and it keeps the lights and mics going. Very much appreciated. Head on over to minimap.com.au for everything else that we have done. Next episode of the show. Done. And once again, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Have a good rest of your evening.